Welcome to the View Magazine's Rebel Justice Podcast from our Someone's Daughter podcast series. This week, we bring you some excerpts from our Women vs. the State live talk, which took place at Photo North Festival in Manchester this past week. In the panel, we had the pleasure to hear from Gail Hatfield Granger, whose partner was unlawfully murdered in an extrajudicial killing by Greater Manchester Police. Mags McNally, her law partner, their client Zaina, and journalist Samantha Asumadu. Zaina, can we start with you, if you'd be happy to tell us what took you to Hatfield Granger and McNally Legal Consultants?
My name is Zaina Imam. On the 5th and 6th of February, I was detained for in excess of 40 hours by Greater Manchester Police at Penderson Police Station. During my time with Greater Manchester Police, I was drugged and raped. Greater Manchester Police told the hospital that they had found me in the state that I was in and they were concerned about me. Prior to arriving at the hospital, I was with Greater Manchester Police, like I said, for 40 hours at Pendleton Police Station. Stupidly, on the 5th of February, I got intoxicated and I felt really unwell. So I made a call to my friend Richard. He called 999. He asked for an ambulance for Greater Manchester Police, turned up first. They dispatched two police vans, one police car, four male officers and a female officer for a check on welfare in a drunken state. And I kind of sometimes blame myself because I believe this is the point that they broke in. I flashed the officers from inside the property. The officers were still outside the property. That is the point that my doors went through. And out of fear, and I think I was startled as well, I accidentally knocked the female officer's glasses off her face. Handcuffs went on and I was put into the back of a van at 2:05 a.m. I remember an officer getting into the vehicle with me. And when the vehicle started moving, I remember feeling dizzy and I passed out. Out of 40 hours of custody footage, they've released 37 hours. The custody records, nothing tallies up. Everything points to JMP. I didn't regain my memory till end of March, early April. But I remember when I was discharged from hospital, I couldn't understand what caused the injuries, why I ended up in hospital. I got fixated with building a timeline. I spoke to everybody that I spoke to on my phone. I made subject access requests. It has been over 14 months and I am still waiting for the subject access request to be supplied to me. I have contacted every organisation I can possibly think of and I'm hitting a brick wall. All I'm asking for is my legal right to be fulfilled. I want the footage because I want to know exactly what these officers did to me whilst I was in custody.
Thank you so much for your share, Zaina. Gail, you have had challenges with the Greater Manchester Police yourself.
Yeah, I just wanted to just touch on Zaina's story as well. So when Zaina's come to us, we've helped to fight for the subject access requests and the videos. We were shocked that they supplied so much footage. And what Zaina was saying is, after so long in the police cell, something would happen. She would be attacked or assaulted in some way, sexually. And then she would come back to the room. But the officers, completely disproportionate of how they even handled her before the attack started to happen. They should have had her on full 24-hour observation. She should have had a mental health, a nurse check and everything. She was failed completely by the police. I think one thing that really stands out as well with a lot of the clients that we work with now is not so much that this happened to them or something happened to them, it's that breakdown of the trust. When the police or the state or prisons break that from you, it shatters your mental state as well because you've lost all faith in the system as well as dealing with what's happened to you. Until there's some kind of closure, this is how the state are leaving women. Because they don't see that, and I'm not saying it's everybody, but for men, and some men with power, and we see it all the time in the news, you know, police officers done for rape, police officers sexual assault, the prisons have done something. When they see a person such as them, they think, surely got sexually assaulted. I mean, it's not major. Let's have a look at the drug person or let's have a look at this. And it's like it gets brushed under as though it's not important, but it is.
Samantha, you have been covering a lot of similar stories as a journalist. Would you like to share more about your experience?
So the reason I've been invited here is because I'm also a journalist and I did an exclusive two-part series on IPPs, which are indeterminate sentences for public protection. I did that for Open Democracy. Basically, I profiled some prisoners who've been in prison mostly over 10 years. And so what I found is in the course of 3 months, I worked in the story and indeterminate sentences for public protection were brought in by the Labour government, specifically Lord Blunkett around 2003, 2004. And what we found was a generation of working class black, Asian and white working class men and women who were put in prison for very minor crimes. To be honest, I don't often ask what crime these people did. It doesn't matter because they, you know, they were put in for a certain thing. 17 years later, they're not in for that. Yeah. I'll tell you, what they're in for is the mental abuse and torture that the prison system has implemented on them over years. And that's documented by psychologists, by their families, and so on. And then, so my editor just asked me, can you go back and just get political reactions to your first story? You know, get some quotes. So I went to Lord Blunkett, the originator of this sentence, who actually campaigns against it now. Now he's not got any power. Because it was banned in 2012 before human rights abuse. Ken Clark got rid of it. What happened in 2012 when the sentence was banned is they didn't retroactively take people out of prison. All these people who had been in, supposed to be in for 2 years, who are now in by 15, 17 years later, were not let out retrospectively. If they do get out sometimes on parole, they're on a licence, any little thing happens and they get put back in, which is another whole big thing. But anyway, I went to get political reactions. I got some from the Lords, Greens, Lib Dems, all these people, all condemning it outright. Yeah, people who campaign for prisons, condemning it outright. And then but I'm still talking to the families, I'm talking to the Ministry of Justice, the parole service, getting quotes from them, blah, blah. And this pattern emerged. And the pattern that happened was I found that what was happening is that the prison service, or someone, nobody's admitting it yet, were putting false crimes on these prisoners' files. Like things that they couldn't have done. Everything I did, I had to get documents, yeah? My editor was not letting me publish anything without documents. Between the Ministry of Justice, parole board, prison service, they're keeping those people in. And I call them political prisoners now. So there's something called a prison cohort, so the type of sentence you get. And so IPPs are the highest suicide rate and they are the highest self-harming. Just a week ago, Dominic Raab has said that he's not going to let these people out. And I believe it's because they know how much compensation they're going to need to give to these people. And as it refers to women, so I'm working on another investigation at the moment, and this has really opened my mind, but I'm looking at what's happening to women in very delicate living circumstances, so precarious living circumstances, you know, renting from this person and that person. And I found over time, I'm not going to go into it too much because I'm still investigating it, but I feel that police and the councils in some way work together to manage and oppress vulnerable women, and they use the mental health holds, what they call, sectioning to do that. And I've found a pattern and hopefully I'll be able to prove it. But I do believe there is an important need for the press to talk about this. And I should say, so I did it for Open Democracy and that's a smaller platform. But I went first to I've written for The Telegraph. They didn't want it. Al Jazeera, New York Times, all these people. And since then, even because the family is still keeping in touch with me, they want justice. They want people out. So I contact journalists and ask them, can you follow this? I've got all these other documents you could use. You could have an exclusive. And ITV did do something, but they didn't talk about the actual real crimes the state are doing, which is the fake crime. People don't care about working class, white, black, brown, women or men, and it's very hard to get that stuff into the press. But I think there will be a barrier that breaks at some point, and stories like Zainab have to come out.
Yes. Mags, you represent Zainab. What would you like to add?
The reason why I wasn't coming in, it's really important. This is just one crime in our office. We have repulsive crimes just like this that nobody's dealing with, all female. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about me. So I'm Mike. I'm one of the directors, along with Gail, of Hatfield Granger and Lannan, legal consultant. I worked in law by accident. I really didn't want to go down that route. I wanted to be a criminologist for Greater Manchester Police, and that was good. So while studying to be a criminologist, they were saying, you know, to go for interviews, and a legal position came up. Unfortunately, I got the job. I spoke to my lecturer. I said, I don't want it. He said, take it. It's a good opportunity. I ended up staying there for 15 years. I was one of the ones that started a prison law business for the firm, which was massive, one of the biggest in the UK. And during doing that, I, I was a prison law lawyer in all the prisons across the UK, male prisons and female prisons. I used to do adjudications in prison. Rather than bringing to court, they bring people in to represent them, you bring the judge in, and it all takes place in court. I've represented women that's been raped by officers, and they managed to walk through. I've represented women who've been impregnated by officers in the prison, not out of choice, forced upon them, and nothing gets done. Although we could represent them, I felt that we needed to do more. So then I became part of taking action against most of the prisons in the UK, judicially reviewing a lot in the female prisons, winning a lot of cases with a team, not just myself, as a team. I then felt, because I was working regulated under the SRA, unfortunately, there's only a certain level you can go to without becoming outside the guidelines. I met Gail 10 years ago, still working in law, and we always talked about the possibility of maybe doing a bit of law stuff together. She was studying law. So we decided that we would start a business, but not a business like typical solicitors firms that you see everywhere in the UK, that where they look at the clients from a monetary point of view, because that's the bit that I always felt uncomfortable with. They were about money, and it wasn't about the person. So I left, and that we started this business. This business represents people. Unfortunately, we've been subjected through the state to what Zane has been subjected to. We have men, male, female, young, old. So we make a noise, and we do spend a lot of time. We do the work on it. Zane's case is going to be big. Yeah. Unfortunately, cases like this, if she went to a solicitor's firm that doesn't work the way we do, they wouldn't take the case on.
Gail, how did you become involved with being a law practitioner?
Similar to Mags, I had no interest in law. I've been a machinist, I've been a mechanic, I've worked in bars, I've worked in clubs, I'm a qualified painter and decorator. I do not care about the law, or at least I didn't. As growing up, I've been through adverse childhood experiences. I've been homeless. I've been with older men from the age of 14, my boyfriend was 22. From the age of 16, my boyfriend was 30. At the age of 15, my boyfriend was 28. Each one of them thought it was okay to beat up a girl. I didn't think anything of it because it had always happened. Then I stayed with my son's dad for 6 years. The day that I found out I was pregnant, I didn't touch another drug because before this, boyfriends who were a bit older think it's okay to give a young girl, it's okay, just take this. And you think, well, actually, you're letting me sleep in your house, you're letting me sleep in your bed. Better do it. So I had a colourful childhood. So like I say, each one of these boyfriends were always a bit handsy. Thought it was okay to give the occasional slap, punch, broken rib, broken nose. And then I met Anthony Granger, who was not like that. So at the age of 26, I found myself pregnant to somebody else's husband. We all got arrested and I was looking at 10 years in prison. And while I was at the police station, the police officer came up to me and he said, "You do know if your boyfriend just goes guilty, you'll walk free." And I said, "Well, I don't want him to go guilty because it's nothing to do with me. You know, I'll fight my own case, thank you." And what he did then was pass me his phone number and say, "Well, when he gets 20 years, give us a call. And when you drop that kid, I'll sort you out." So I thought, I'm definitely winning this case. So I started studying law. Not studying law, but started looking into the law. Fought my case. I was on trial. 5 trials, 4 different juries, 2.5 years. It was one of the biggest drug sagas that happened in Greater Manchester. We all got not guilty. And I got not guilty. Yeah. But by this time, I had to work. I had to be in court 5 days a week. I had to be a mum to a newborn child and a 9-year-old. And I really got this feeling against Greater Manchester Police because it set us up. And as we were walking out, I was on trial with Anthony Granger, who at the time wasn't my boyfriend. We got together during the trial whilst I was pregnant with my daughter. Police officer knocked into him and went, "Don't think this is over yet, you prick." Less than a year later, he was shot dead by Greater Manchester Police. So I didn't know what to do. First thing you do, I thought, right, well, I'm going to all these meetings, these IOPC meetings. I didn't have a clue what they were saying. There was all acronyms and, well, part of the CTFSO and IOPC and CPS. And I thought, okay, well. So I went to college. So I studied psychology, social policy, politics and everything just to get me into university, because in case you haven't noticed, I'm a mature student. So got into university, studied law and criminology. During this time, 5 years down the line, we still not had anything done. The police officer actually got promoted in the meantime and shot him. So then I started meeting other people that had been affected by the state, so big names like Janet Alder, you know. And basically what happens is when somebody is killed by the state, which is what I specialise in, it's often a man. When you do studies, it's very, very rarely a woman. And all of it does happen. So then what's left behind? A mother, a wife, somebody with children. You've then got to teach your child that the police aren't bad, and if anything ever happens, go to the police and make sure everything's all right. Well, really, you're sitting there thinking, don't trust the police. But you can't instill that into your children. You've got to work to make the money, because you don't get funding for inquests when somebody's been killed by the police. You don't get any help. You don't get any support. So whilst I was doing that, I was obviously working, studying, and then we got a landmark decision on our case. So that night when he was sat there, when 16 armed officers, none of them wearing a police badge, none of them in a police car, and they pulled up into the car park that night and they shot him within under 3 seconds. I didn't get told till the day after. I was at home making tea for him. They didn't even bother coming telling me. I actually had to Google it when someone told me. Also, after this, I've been stalked, because I get quite a few strange people. I ring the police. They've never been out. I've been stalked where people are putting pictures of me online and threatening me. I've threatened our business.
So what do you think can be done? I mean, raising awareness is very important, isn't it, Zaina?
To me, I'm not bothered about my anonymity. It's gone past that stage. To me, I lost everything that night. So for me, if I can warn as many people, the people that are here that you can tell your mothers, your fathers, sisters, your friends.
And why haven't we seen your case on the news yet?
We've got meetings on next week.
If she wasn't with us, she could go straight to them. But because we're preparing a case, something she could do could jeopardise the preparation of the case. Don't worry, once the case is out there, you'll see this everywhere. But the thing is, if we allow her to do that now, then the jeopardy to her would be irreparable.
And this concludes our podcast for today with excerpts from the live talk Women vs. the State, which took place at Photo North Festival in Manchester. Thank you very much to the speakers for their shares. You can find out more about Someone's Daughter exhibition at theviewmag.org.uk. The View is the only organization in the third sector that puts women with lived experience at the heart of all that we do, from our board to our volunteers. The View is a living community that is creating a brighter future through art, storytelling, and hope. Come and be part of our brave mission and vision for a fair world. Thank you for listening.